The Fourth District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has reconvened. The Honorable Robert J. Steigman presiding.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bailiff. This next case on our call this afternoon is 4-24-1194, Project IS43:19 LLC versus Vandenberg House LLC. Would counsel for the appellant please state your name?
Good morning. May it please the court. Michael Rosenhaus.
Thank you, and counsel for the appellee.
Donald Craven.
Thank you, counsel. And before we begin, I want to thank both of you for being available early so we can start early as well, and appreciate that courtesy. And with that, then, Mr. Rosenhaus, on behalf of the appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. I think basically, excuse me, the arguments have been pretty well covered in the brief, and I would anticipate primarily being available for questions, but by way of a brief recap, our primary contention is that the relationship of lessor and lessee did not exist at the time of the complaint. It most certainly did not exist after the parties entered into a formal contract for the sale of the real estate while the litigation was pending in July. And thereafter, it did not exist at the time of trial. There was no lease, legally speaking, there was no lease in effect. The purchase option had been exercised. The parties were attempting to close the purchase, in which they would make whatever arrangements or adjustments they deemed necessary if there were any remaining under the lease. So we think this is something that goes to the heart of the matter under the Eviction Act. This simply was not a legitimate case under the Eviction Act because of this exercise of the purchase option and the supersession of the lessor-lessee relationship by the vendor and vendee relationship. And we.
Counsel, if I may, though,
Yes.
to kind of focus on that, because I know you're talking about that a bit, but do you think that the changes in 1970 to the Constitution and the decision in Belleville Toyota, which is 199 Illinois 2nd 235, after that it seemed pretty clear that the subject matter jurisdiction is conferred on the circuit court by way of the Illinois Constitution. Would you agree with that?
I think I would not agree with that. I would think that's taking Belleville Toyota further than its language and the history of the Supreme Court decision making since then. Allows, as I tried to point out in the brief, there have been decisions since Belleville. Belleville does not signal the end of special jurisdictional, the jurisdictional nature of special statutory proceedings, such as this case, and such as in some of the cases we cited, proceedings involving the mentally handicapped. In fact, there's a history of Illinois Supreme Court decisions in which these special statutory requirements have been upheld as jurisdictional. And so that it's not unfair to say that the importance of Belleville may be limited to only one of the 2 points that we raised under our heading of jurisdiction, which is the inadequacy of the notice, because most of the Belleville line of cases do seem to be focused on timeliness. That said, I think the Belleville line of cases does not really do away with this limited subject matter jurisdiction. This is a case under the Eviction Act. I don't think Belleville would say you can go into and, proceed under the Eviction Act under the special short notice and summary proceedings made available under the Eviction Act, and you can file a consumer protection case or a matrimonial case. I mean, you can only take Belleville so far. I don't think it still has to be an eviction case. There still has to be an underlying right of possession. But it's
So I have a
still
question.
jurisdictional.
I have a question, counsel. Is the fundamental issue in this case whether the Massachusetts Forum Selection Clause in the document the parties signed in September 22 applies?
That is certainly one of the three questions that we raise, and it's an important question. Yes, the court should have respected the forum, excuse me, the forum selection clause. There is no evidence of an Illinois policy prohibiting the litigation of disputes under these documents in the Massachusetts court as the parties agreed to do.
So I have my follow-up question is, this Massachusetts Forum Selection Clause appears in the document the parties signed in September of 2022. How many pages is that document?
Offhand, I don't know, but I do have the documents here. I'm not, if the point, and I can get the exact number of pages, but
I'm just wondering, to what extent is this a very lengthy document, and this forum selection clause is like some sort of footnote buried within it someplace?
oh no, it's not in a footnote. It's in one of the substantive paragraphs. I'll see if I can find it. But more than that, this is really a commercial lease between two commercial entities, which and the fact that the lease is lengthy and detailed shows that these parties are sophisticated parties, each with lawyers and fully equipped and able to negotiate the terms of the lease as they see fit, and not be compelled to sign something against their interest. I don't think it you can compare it to a consumer protection situation where you have a big company on one side and a consumer buying something and or checking off a box on I accept the terms and conditions on a website, for example. It's not that type of situation. This is a fully negotiated lease with lawyers on both sides, and that was what the parties agreed to.
So your position is the forum selection clause saying that litigation concerning this document would be held in Massachusetts was enforceable, and the trial court erred by not enforcing it?
Yes, Your Honor, that's our position.
What did the trial court say about why it wasn't going to acknowledge or enforce that provision?
Well, that's an important part of the argument. The court based it on public policy considerations without providing any source for the conclusion that Illinois had a strong public policy requiring litigation of dispute under the lease to take place in Illinois because it's an Illinois property. It's a routine for states, including both Illinois and Massachusetts, to be litigating real estate controversies based on real estate in other states. Now, when it comes time to actually enforce whatever a court decides and to go and have somebody step onto the law enforcement, step onto the real estate if necessary to enforce a party's rights, certainly that has to be done in Illinois. But that doesn't mean that the Adjudication has to take place in Illinois. Courts all over the country do this all the time. Illinois adjudicating rights of Indiana properties and so on. And by the way, all the courts do, it's part of accepted conflict of laws that the courts do recognize that the other states have an interest in having their own laws enforced with respect to property within their boundaries, and Massachusetts recognizes that. So that if it came up in Massachusetts, presumably, if something needed to be decided under Illinois law, it would be decided under Illinois law. And the but the underlying point on jurisdiction is that the court decided on public policy grounds. It was very simple. That was the basis of its decision, and that was an error. It just has not been supported.
In fact, it would be true, wouldn't it, that there'd be a lot easier and more direct just to have litigation right here in Illinois?
I Perhaps it would be easier from some point of view that you would have a, but the property is in Illinois. But again, there's no policy requiring the court to ignore the forum that the parties selected. They did agree on this, so there's no basis for ignoring that provision. You really have to show that you just, for some reason, whoever is complaining about that is really saying they really just can't get a fair trial in this other forum. And there's no claim that this would be the situation here. It's not a consumer situation. It's not a situation involving pre social or political prejudice of any kind. It's a simple forum selection clause, and these are routinely respected.
One last question on
One minute.
this.
Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Is my understanding correct that you're characterizing both of these litigants as corporations which deal with property and are relatively sophisticated and have counsel, experienced counsel advising them regarding the contract that was entered into? Is that your position?
Well, I am would not go beyond what the papers themselves show. That's all
Isn't that
that's
what you should
before the
know?
court. The papers show that these are limited liability companies. The papers show that they were represented by counsel, or they're represented by counsel now. Certainly, they can afford lawyers. I don't think this is a case of unequal bargaining power, as if one is some giant corporation and the other is a poor consumer. This is somebody from Arizona, owning property in Illinois and renting it out to a business, and it's a business, one business renting from another. So I don't think there are any. I'm sorry.
Justice Leonard, I interrupted you, and please go ahead.
No, I think I interrupted you, but thank you. Just as a follow-up for clarification at the trial court level, and I know that the there's been arguments made in the briefs that perhaps this is not an inconvenient forum, and that might be a basis as to why the forum selection clause should not be enforced. But was that developed at the trial court level at all? Or was the trial court's basis solely that it violated public policy?
Well, based on the order that was prepared by opposing counsel at the time, based in which is the final order that's being appealed from, the one and only ground was public policy. No other grounds were mentioned. So that's the record, and I think the record is sufficient for the court to proceed and look at it and say this is an error.
Following up with that as well, at any point in time, was there any argument with regards to the execution of the contract, where it was signed under duress or that fraud was involved? I did not find anything along the lines in the record, but I wanted to verify that.
Not that I was able to find in the record. No, there is no such argument.
All right. Thank you. I have no further questions.
Let me
Yeah,
continue.
interesting. Oh, just to return to the jurisdiction argument, tie the loose ends together, even after all is said and done, the bottom line of opposing of the opposition's answer to the jurisdiction argument was, well, this is something the significance of it being jurisdiction was, can it be raised for the first time on appeal? Well, the record shows that this issue of the non-exit of the purchase option, changing the nature of the party's relationship, is not being raised for the first time on appeal in any event. It pervades the answer and counterclaim that was submitted by Vanderberg. It's all over. They want their purchase option enforced. And as I said before, forgive me if I'm re for repeating, but this not only was the option exercised at the time of the contract, but while this litigation was pending, the parties actually entered into a contract for the sale of the real estate, and that's in the exhibits. They entered into a contract for the sale of the real estate, and they planned a closing. So, any argument that, well, we're not really it's not really sure that the option was exercised is really rendered irrelevant by that factual development. And that continued to the very end of the litigation. So that what you have actually at the end of the litigation, the day of trial, they were supposed to have closed the purchase the day of trial. Well, the closing didn't fall through. We don't know really who was at fault, although the court did try to say something about it. But we have enough from the record to see that they were trying to close the purchase the day before. You have a whole new situation on the day of trial. It's no longer what you have is parties who tried to close a real estate deal and the deal didn't close. And all the judgment below ignores completely ignores this fact. So.
Anything further, counsel?
I have nothing further. Be happy to answer any more questions, Your Honor.
Well, I see now you'll have an opportunity to address us again in rebuttal. Mr. Craven, on behalf of the appellee, you may make your argument, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. The looks, I think we need to start with a little timing. The lease was entered into in 2022, as Your Honor noted. January 12th of 2024, Mr. Passwater sends a letter indicating that his client intends to exercise its right to purchase and sets a closing date of February 15th of 2024. February 15th comes and goes. The defendant now takes the position that with that January 12th letter, the lease is, for lack of a better word, subsumed into the contract. The lease terminates on January 12th, 2024. They're no longer operating under the terms of the lease, and they're operating under the contract to purchase. They blew that closing in February on February 15th. So as of February 16th, they have no possessory interest in this real estate. The lease is gone, according to them, and the real estate closing has come and gone and didn't occur. They're squatters. We gave them notice of termination. We gave them probably more notice than they were entitled to under the law. We gave them a 10-day notice, served it on March 19th, served it on March 20th. And proceeded with this litigation to terminate their tenancy, whatever type of tenancy it might have been at that point. I believe that I disagree with counsel on the reading of Belleville Toyota. I think the 1970 Constitution solves this problem. If there are shortcomings in the actions of a landlord attempting to terminate a tenancy, those deficiencies can be raised in a motion to dismiss, but it does not raise a jurisdictional issue.
Mr. Craven, as I ask Mr. Rosenhaus, I want to ask you as well about the forum selection clause. The trial court refused to abide by it. The first question is, are we dealing with sophisticated corporations involved in land matters represented by counsel as opposed to the old story of the little old widow lady confronted with the adhesion contract by State Farm Insurance. This isn't that case, is it?
I don't believe it's that case, Judge, but very frankly, there is nothing in this record to establish that the plaintiff is a sophisticated landowner. There's nothing in this record to establish that the plaintiff was represented by counsel at the time they signed this lease. I think from the form of the lease, it's rather easy to tell that it's a form lease developed by the defendant. And used in their properties across the country. But no, there's nothing in this record to establish that we're dealing with sophisticated corporations, both represented by counsel.
Well, they're both corporations dealing with land matters, are they not?
Yes.
Okay. Well, so I'm just wondering why if there's this, and by the way, I asked the same question of Mr. Rosenhaus, so let me ask you, how big was this contract and how many pages and what portion or where did this form selection provision appear?
If I recall right, and pardon me while I look away to look at the exhibit, I believe it's a 15-page contract. And the forum selection clause. It's not jumping out at me.
Well, it's in 15 pages someplace, which already limits the amount of pages one has to study and consider to find this provision present. And isn't the law on this point, Mr. Craven, that sophisticated parties negotiating at arm's length agree to litigate in a given form, that they're presumably aware of the difficulties of that and agreed anyway, and absent some compelling and countervailing reason that selection should be enforced.
There, as a first of all, if I could just provide the court with the answer to the preceding question, it's on page 10 in a paragraph titled Legal
Okay.
in Article 26 labeled Miscellaneous. Generally speaking, yes, I agree with Your Honor that generally speaking, you've stated the law. The court
What are the
found that
compelling and countervailing reasons in this case before us, on this record, why the forum selection should not be respected?
two things, and then I have another answer to your question as well.
Okay.
The The plaintiff is in Arizona. The defendant is in Missouri. I'm sorry, Massachusetts, one of those M states. And obviously, it would be difficult to do litigation from
More difficult
Arizona.
counsel, though. How is it more difficult counsel to go from Arizona to Illinois than necessarily Arizona to Massachusetts?
You meet in the middle. And very frankly, the other part of the answer is the Illinois statute requires that litigation of this sort be brought in the county in which the real estate is located. So
Well,
there
counsel, there's
is
no suggestion in the statute itself that specifically says the parties cannot contract around that. There's nothing to suggest that that provision cannot be waived, as is set forth in other specific statutes.
I agree with you that it says it can't be waived. It simply says shall be brought in the county in which the real estate is located.
So it is a special venue proceeding, but when we're talking about the public policy, it's not akin to other examples that were set forth in the brief where it specifically prohibits that. And this is about possession. It's not an MREM proceeding, and it doesn't deal with, ownership. It's just who has the better right to possession, correct?
Correct. But
And
the other
if I
problem
could,
with
circling
sure.
back to Justice Steigman's question, though, with regards to the parties themselves, I mean, the parties also negotiated, did they not, that the option to purchase would be governed by the laws of the state of Illinois. So they appeared to be familiar with how they could negotiate those provisions, correct?
Again, there's nothing in the record to indicate that the terms of the lease were negotiated. It's just as likely that the lease was simply presented to plaintiff, and he executed it.
This
The
is
other
the
problem.
Godfather scenario, Mr. Craven. Either sign it or I got a gun to your head
I
and your
got
signature, your blood will be over the contract. Is that it?
there's nothing in the record to support it. The problem, a lot of the problem in this case is there's not a record. And there's no bystanders report. The history was lost, but an underlying problem with the defendant's reliance on the forum selection clause is counsel for the defendant just spent 12 minutes telling us that the lease doesn't exist anymore. That when they gave
What if he's
notice,
wrong?
well. He's wrong on several points, Your Honor, but he can't say the lease doesn't exist and then say you got to enforce the forum selection clause. If you got to enforce
Argue
the
he's wrong, the lease exists, and if you're correct, then aren't we back to the forum selection clause?
No, because at the time we started this litigation, they'd abandoned the lease, so they say.
Justice
We've lost.
Steigman, I believe we've lost
Lost.
the opposing party.
Right.
Oh.
Just a minute ago. He's coming back.
Okay.
There he is. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you,
And
Justice Zeno. Okay,
you're
go ahead.
welcome.
I apologize, Mr. Craven. I don't know if you recall where we were.
I was in the middle of a great speech, Judge. I just don't
I'm sure
remember
you
what it
were.
was.
Go ahead.
The forum, if the lease is in place, then they've got to pay rent. They're taking the position they don't have to pay rent because they exercised the option. They don't get to cherry pick which provisions of the lease are going to be in place. There is also a question which we've raised in our brief about whether the question of the forum selection clause is even before this court.
Let's talk about that a moment, counsel, because you did suggest, and admittedly, The appellant did not identify the May 22nd, 2024 order in its notice of appeal. However, it did request the reversal and remand of all issues and judgments contained in the August 14th, 2024 order. So why shouldn't our review of that August 14th, 2024 order conclude that it directly related back to the court's previous order, denying Vanderburgh House's motion to dismiss based on the forum selection clause, such that we would be determining it was a step in the procedural progression leading to the judgment?
I would simply repeat that they didn't include that order in their notice of appeal. They didn't bring that issue to this court. The August 14 order recaps the procedural history, but the court denied the issues regarding the forum selection clause in a separate order, and that was not brought before this court.
Mr. Craven, in response to my question about the enforcement of the forum selection clause and the problems with doing that, the first point you raised is that the plaintiffs are in Arizona and the defendants are in Massachusetts. And my question is, that was the case when this contract was signed, and you say there's no evidence it was negotiated, but my godfather representation only half jokingly. We have a 15-page contract signed by multiple corporations, and in the absence of some threats or other unusual behavior, I think there's every reason to assume that it was negotiated between these people, and this was between those parties. And this provision about where two things: one, the forum selection was present in that negotiated contract, and two, they were already in these distant states when it was negotiated. So why should your first explanation be given any weight at all?
There is in the record it's a document titled Response to Defendant's Objections to Jurisdiction, Motion to Dismiss, and Motion to Quash. In paragraph 13 on page of an affidavit of plaintiff's representative attached to that document is a statement from plaintiff's rep that says the forum selection clause found within a paragraph titled legal on page 10 of the lease was not negotiated or bargained for. Paragraph 14, in fact, I, on behalf of project, the plaintiff, engaged in no discussions or negotiations whatsoever with defendant and or its representatives concerning this specific clause in the lease relating to litigating issues in Worcester County, Massachusetts. Paragraph 11, representatives of the defendant prepared the lease.
So what does this mean? I mean, here's the corporation dealing with land is presented with a lease, contains this forum selection provision, never apparently made any objections to it, didn't raise a question, and then that means that gives them additional basis to say, hey, it's not enforceable because we didn't negotiate it. I'm not sure where this explanation goes.
What I'm suggesting, Your Honor, is that this might be closer to your little old lady in State Farm than too sophisticated than State Farm and Allstate. There's nothing in the record about how much real estate is in this LLC. There's nothing in the record that indicates that this LLC owns more than just one building in Springfield, Illinois.
Well, if someone is trying to undo a contract on the basis that it's an adhesion provision and it's not fair, and it's like the little old lady in State Farm, isn't there a burden to establish these facts on the record and to cite some public policy provisions that would render this contractual provision something which can be ignored as a matter of public policy? And where does that apply?
I would refer you to the, and I, if you wish, I can find this document in the record, but I would point you to this response that obviously persuaded Judge Breaux that there are reasons to not enforce a forum selection clause in Massachusetts. And I like the court and like counsel, none of us were present when this motion was argued to Judge Breaux. There is no record and there's no bystanders report, so we don't know everything that was stated to Judge Breaux.
Well, another question about all this: isn't the rule in Illinois, as I suggested, that absent some compelling and countervailing reason why a forum selection clause should not be enforced, it should be enforced? And in that regard, you're an experienced litigator, Mr. Craven, and when talks about absent some compelling and countervailing reason, if you're arguing that that's the doctrine that should apply, it's would be your burden to present and convince the trial court and this court about the existence of whatever that compelling and countervailing reason is. I just don't see it in this record.
Paragraph 16 of that same document cites to Keats versus Cates as the situs of as the state of the situs of the property. Illinois courts have jurisdiction not only to determine the ownership of real estate, but may impose obligations upon persons in an action arising from the ownership, use, or possession of property within the state.
Of course, that would be true always in the absence of a forum selection clause. But does that trump a forum selection clause?
Yes, the strong public policy of the state of Illinois is that litigation involving specifically eviction cases be litigated in the county in which the real estate is located. And as noted, an important part of that issue is in the enforcement.
Your time's up, but I want you to be able to finish, Mr.
Okay, thank I didn't know what the I'm new to the beep.
Go ahead.
The enforcement of an eviction judgment would re if it requires the assistance of the Sangamon County Sheriff is going to involve the Sangamon County courts as well.
Thank you, Mr. Craven. Mr. Rosenhaus, on behalf of the appellant, you make your rebuttal argument at this time.
I think the court and its questions has touched upon many of the points that I would have raised in the rebuttal. I just didn't want to ignore the third point in the brief, which was the default order. And I wanted to emphasize that Vandenberg, the defendant, was defaulted and never had an opportunity to present its case based on an error. The error being that the defendant did not appear. It simply is not true as a matter of law that because the representative, the individual human representative of the LLC was barred from testifying, that means that the defendant failed to appear and can therefore be defaulted, and as such that the plaintiff does not have to prove its case as to liability, and the court can go directly to damages. There was no the defense the LLC did appear through its counsel and should not have been defaulted. Other than that, I would rest and again welcome any other questions that the court might have.
I see none. So I thank you,
Your
Mr.
Honor.
Russell Walsh and Mr. Craven, for your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement, issue a decision in due course.